You're listening to Orange County's only station with critical business information, Critical Mass, with your host, Rick Franzi.
Yes, hello, and good afternoon. This is your radio show host, Rick Franzi, on Critical Mass, the radio show on octalkradio.net. Excited to be here on our Thursday afternoon installment of this fine program on this great radio station. Actually, this is our 51st installment of Critical Mass, the radio show. My partner, Doug Gefeller, and I co-host this business talk show. It airs every Tuesday, Wednesday, and now Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. here Pacific Standard Time, or Pacific Daylight Savings Time, I guess, for another couple days. Our guests today, we actually have guest number 70 and guest number 71. Our first guest, I'd like to just make sure that Stacy's on the line. And so let me check and just say, hello, Stacy. Are you on the line this afternoon?
I am.
Okay, that is Stacy Clifford Kitts, and we're going to be back with her shortly to have an in-depth conversation about a range of topics. But before we do that, I just wanted to say that our goal for this show is to help business owners and top executives make better, more informed decisions. Doug and I do that by interviewing thought leaders such as Stacy and executives who are knowledgeable about a range of ideas. And we're really looking for transferable learning events, things that our guests know, that experiences that they have, that our listening audience can learn by the act of listening to the interview that's upcoming. This show is really an extension of our 15-year business practice where Doug and I build executive forums, and that's for top executives here in Orange County, California. Doug and I do it under the brand name Renaissance Executive Forums, and Doug and I currently lead multiple peer groups here in Orange County. We offer a differentiated experience for these business owners and executives because our research shows that 80% of the issues and opportunities, frankly, that a top executive faces are common with those of other top executives who are also leading similarly sized firms. Recently, my book, Critical Mass, has been called the definitive guide to the CEO peer group experience. And for those of you that might be interested, it's available on Amazon.com. If you'd like to learn more about executive forums, the different things that Doug and I are doing here in Critical Mass for Business, I'd encourage you to check out our website, which is www.criticalmassforbusiness. Our guest, our first guest here this afternoon, as I said in the open, is Stacy Clifford Kitts. And we're going to be talking with Stacy about how her use of social media has affected her CPA practice. And Stacy owns Clifford Kitts CPA, and she's owned it since 2008 when she decided to leave her previous position with a prominent CPA firm here in Orange County. Stacy received her Bachelor's of Arts in Business from California State University, San Bernardino, and she graduated with honors. So it is an honor, if I would say so myself, a little pun intended there, to invite Stacy to join us on this call. And Stacy, welcome to Critical Mass as heard on octalkradio.net.
Thanks, Rick. And I just want to say before we start this, as my own personal little PSA here, is that I hope everybody out there who needs it has gotten their flu shot, because I hope I don't have like a coughing fit in the middle of this, because I've been swigging Dayquil out of the bottle like it's a flask all day to hope I won't interrupt this with a big coughing fit, because I have been a little bit sick, so my voice is a little scratchy.
Yeah, we can kind of hear that in your voice a little bit, and yeah. You have my empathy, I guess, because I know you sound better today than I imagined you felt earlier in this week, and I'm really excited that you've been able to muster it up and be here as our guest this afternoon. So, Stacy, could we start by having you tell our audience about your path to your current business?
Well, certainly. I think really what drove me to opening my own practice was, I guess, a basic, maybe a could be described as a philosophical difference between myself and maybe the typical firm partner. Not all partners, but let's say the typical one. And what I mean by that is CPA firms, they tend to operate under a generally accepted, if you will, formula that has been around since the beginning of time, seems like. And that firm formula has stuff like criteria for retaining and promoting staff, or how a CPA firm will market itself, how business is built, how work is assigned and completed, and what else? Oh, and who and why certain people may or may not be promoted to partner. And I really felt that some firms were having some trouble recognizing, maybe even embracing new attitudes towards, like, work ethics and new trends such as internet marketing and social networking, maybe even telecommuting and job sharing and paperless work environments. And since I was interested in exploring some of these new non-traditional avenues, and I felt that working in a traditional firm environment was really going to impede my ability to pursue some of these new trends, I felt it was important for me to kind of step out on my own. But, you know, in relation to that, I do want to point out that the firm I spent most of my public accounting career with prior before I opened my own practice, they really were pretty fabulous in accommodating my needs because I was a single parent at the time. And I had this one tax partner who I worked under who was particularly good, and he really went out of his way to make it possible for me as a single mom to be able to do my job, which was really important. And in fact, there's this, I like to tell this story because it's just such a great story. There was this one instance when I'd brought my kids to the office during a work day during busy season because they were sick and I couldn't leave them in daycare. And so I'd stashed them, kind of like hidden them away in the conference room and popped a movie in the VCR so to kind of keep them occupied so I was working on a return. And later I found out that that same partner had scheduled a meeting in that conference room, but when he found out that there were sick kids in there, he rescheduled the whole meeting so he wouldn't disturb my kids, which I thought was just great. I mean, who does that? So, you know, I'm sure that that sort of thing doesn't really happen that often, and particularly in today's environment, and particularly at that same firm because it's really grown in size. And, you know, when the firms get bigger, they get much more bureaucratic. But at the time, it really instilled loyalty in me towards that partner and that firm because the attitude was very untraditional, and particularly as it was relating to, you know, how to help a single mom get her job done. And I really think that having my own practice really allows me to have those kind, to be able to make those kind of decisions and the ability to be more liberal towards the needs of my staff. And, you know, right now, in my office here, I have a desk attached to a treadmill. And, you know, and that really helps me to kind of, you know, get my job done and get exercise in at the same time. But I just don't know how that would go over in a traditional firm environment. So that's kind of how come I felt the need to kind of get out on my own.
I got a mental image of, well, it's obvious with you being a little bit under the weather that you're not on a treadmill at this
No,
very
not
moment.
Right now. But, you know, I could be at some point or another. You never know.
Oh, that's classics. So really, the work environment that you were in was perfectly acceptable, and in many ways it sounds like you were really with a very caring and somewhat progressive organization, kind of driven from the top, which is great. But what you really saw was an opportunity to take that even further relative to how you envisioned a firm could be operated, and that's really why I think, Stacy, you've gone out on your own and formed your own CPA firm. Is that what I'm hearing from your...
Absolutely, that's totally okay. Correct. I had a lot of really positive experiences and learned a lot from the people I've worked with in the past and the firm environments that I've worked with. But, you know, everybody comes to a point in their career where they got to decide, is this the marriage I'm going to have or am I going to have a different one? And mm-hmm. for me, not because that one situation was bad at all. I mean, obviously it's been working for, you know, decades. That kind of firm mentality has been working. But for me, it was just kind of like, you know, I'm going to try something different. And so that's what I did.
I'm sorry, but that's a common, I think a lot of our listening audience can connect to where you were, because many times business owners, entrepreneurs that we interview and talk to and get to know, it's not because where they left they had to leave or they felt they didn't fit in any longer. It's because they had a higher calling maybe, or they had a desire to try to do something that really was in their own image. And you could have frankly stayed at your previous employer and maybe tried to do that through the organization over time. But you could also realize that probably more quickly by taking on more risk, which is to start, hang out your shingle, if I can say that, and start your own firm. So, but let me ask you, Stacy, can you explain to our audience what it is that Clifford Kitts CPA does?
Yes, sir. If you visit my website, you will see, you know, I've got my bio up there, so you could read about my experience and the services I offer. But in general, my client base consists of high net worth individuals and their closely held businesses. And, you know, certainly for this particular group of high net worth individuals, it's important that they find service providers who are experienced with dealing with their particular needs. And what I mean by that is high net worth individuals have specific situations, including family dynamics, which often, you know, consists of things like gifting issues or managing trusts or maybe estate planning issues. And they often have closely held businesses which have succession planning maybe needed for them. And as it relates to, like, a closely held business, for instance, it's important for considerations to be made about what they may be planning on doing with their business in the future. For instance, when they want to retire, or will they want to sell their business in the future? Will they pass it on to a family member? You know, these types of things should be addressed, and it's important that someone experienced with helping with those kinds of planning and decision-making processes is available to them to help implement their goals. And so that's one of the things that I do. And one of the other things that I do is I have a pension audit practice. And for people who don't know what pension audits are, are audits of financial statements of certain types of retirement plans. And the audits are needed in order to comply with the plan's reporting requirements under the Department of Labor rules and regulations for reporting under ERISA. And ERISA is the Employment, Retirement, and Income Securities Act. And these audited financial statements that I do are then attached and filed with the plan's Form 5500. And a Form 5500, as I keep going on about this, is an informational tax return that is filed with the Department of Labor and the Internal Revenue Service. So I help provide the audited financial statements for retirement plans so that they can follow all their informational documents that they need to file.
So it's obvious that you can take the CPA out of the numbers, but you can't take the forms and numbers out of the CPA. Is that
right?
Yeah,
that's absolutely true.
So it's clear, ladies and gentlemen in the audience, that Stacy knows what she's talking about. One of the things that you mentioned to me was that in working with your specific client base, that obviously you're a CPA, and for heaven's sakes, you know how to do the traditional CPA work. We just kind of evidenced that in your answer. But you also help them to focus on understanding what they want and where they want to go with their, you know, with maybe
with
it's a business or their financial position. Would you spend a minute and talk about that as well?
Well, certainly. Sometimes I think a lot of people, when they have a business, like they think people expect them to want to grow it and make it larger and be this big conglomerate and stuff. And a lot of people, when they start a business, that's kind of their goal. They want, you know, I've got to start this business, and it's going to be this great thing, and I'm going to make all this money. But once they start getting into it, they find out, you know what, maybe I just want to be comfortable, and I want to have time to spend with my family, or I want to retire at a certain age. And so what I like to do is try to get really familiar with my clients so I can help them to kind of talk through what it is that they really want. You know, do they really want this big thing that they've got to manage? Do they want it, the company to run itself? Do they like being really involved in it? You know, do we maybe need to look for somebody else who can help them run it? You know, those kind of things. Because usually what your goal is when you start a company isn't necessarily maybe the same goal 10 years down the road, because sometimes the grass is greener. And what we want to do is make sure that we structure somebody's life, financially speaking, so that they can reach the goals that they want. And I help pull in other service providers as well, you know, especially if you're a high net worth individual, you usually have some other kind of financial investments and stuff, and we like to pull in other people to help them kind of structure their world so that they end up where they really want to go. So that's kind of one of the other things that I like to help my clients do.
Well, I'm glad you took a moment and reflected on that aspect of what your firm does for your clients as well. It leads me, Stacy, to the next question that Doug and I enjoy asking each of our guests, and it's a question we do ask each guest, and that is, of all the things you've learned in being in business and supporting businesses and running your own business now, is there one or an overarching kind of principle that you use relative to how you approach your business practice?
Yeah, you know what, there is, actually, and I've thought about this. The most important thing that I've learned through my experiences is to be persistent. And I say that because my path, or the path that led me to my practice, was probably not what one would be considered as a traditional path, and I didn't follow any formula, that's for sure. But definitely, my practice definitely came through being persistent. And I say that because how I got into accounting was kind of different. Way back when I was in my early 20s, I had worked in some accounting clerk type positions. That's kind of like an AR, AP kind of data entry kind of job. And I had heard of this bookkeeper position at this large publicly traded company, and they were looking to fill this position. And I was interested in it, but mainly just because it paid more than the job that I had. And they were looking for someone who they can train, but someone who had knowledge of basic accounting. And since I really wanted the position, and I had absolutely no idea what a bookkeeper did, but I did know that it had something to do with accounting. So I drove down to the college bookstore and purchased an Accounting 101 textbook. And then I went home and studied it for a couple of days and then went to the interview. And I had managed to teach myself enough accounting that I actually got this job, which was amazing. And then after I had worked there, you have to imagine, this is a large publicly traded company, so they have kind of like rules in their accounting departments about what kind of people will run certain things. So after I'd been there a few months, I found out that, yeah, I had this aptitude for accounting, but I would never get promoted unless I had a college degree. So I had to go to college. So I decided to go to college, but I also continued to work. And so I guess that process took me like 10 years. And during that time, I worked full-time and went to school for about 2 out of those 10 years. And also, my husband relocated for a job at least 2 or 3 times, so I ended up attending colleges in like 4 different states. And if you haven't ever done that before, let me tell you, it's unfortunate because different colleges have different criteria for their degree programs. Sure. So I ended up taking probably a year or more worth of classes than I would have normally had to have taken so I could graduate. You know, it seemed like I was in college forever. But I guess the moral of the story is to be persistent because, you know, eventually it led to my own practice.
That's a great answer, and I want to thank you for that because I believe persistence is a key attribute of successful people as well. And so, interestingly enough, you're our first guest who I can recall who had that topic. And so thanks for sharing that with us. I enjoyed that. I hopefully the audience did as well. Anyway, I'd like to ask you because, you know, we build your interview today about your use of social media. And for the audience's information, that's sort of how I discovered you was through the professional way that you position yourself through the blogs that you maintain and the other things that you're doing in the use of social media. And this is an important topic for me because I believe those business owners and top executives who really understand social media and apply it inside their business do have the opportunity to position themselves in the marketplace as a differentiated service provider. Clearly, that's how I see you, and that's why I invited you to be a guest on our show. But can you explain your blogs? I know that you're maintaining, too, the business perspective and Stacy More Tax Tips, and how that activity has affected your practice as a CPA?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to say that as a full practitioner, the reason why I started the blogs was I really felt it was important for me to find a way to showcase my talent and maybe even to instill some confidence in potential clients if they were trying to get some information about me. So my website, along with the blogs, have given me a forum to do that. And I've gotten a lot of positive feedback regarding my Internet presence, including by you. Thank you very much. And including the blogging. But you know what? It's certainly no secret that the Internet is one of the first places where people go to find out information about a multitude of things, including service providers, which I am one. And I know that I do that usually when I meet someone and I'm interested in finding out more information about them. The first thing I do is go back to my office and Google. And if I can find information about their background or maybe even articles, that's even better, articles that they have written about topics in their field, it helps me to understand better their level of expertise. So having a blog and having an Internet presence is another way to market yourself and your firm, and definitely a blog helps you to do that.
Okay. But you're doing, in addition to your blogs, as you said, you're maintaining a very professional website. You're also on other tools such as Facebook.
Yeah, you know what? The social networking in general, I use Twitter and Facebook, and I blog. Those are really three. I haven't gotten into a lot of the other, like MySpace and some of those other. Oh, and LinkedIn, too. I would say that from a social networking standpoint, Facebook is an active social networking where you can really find out about something about people on a personal level, and so that you can get to know people better. So I use those to kind of get my message out there. I'll post pictures of my grandchildren up there, or maybe even talk to people directly back and forth about what may be going on in their personal lives as well as professionally, because again, it's social networking. It's about being social. It's about getting to know people. It's not any different than going out to have drinks with somebody or dinner with somebody when you meet them at a social event in person. So that's one thing that people need to understand, is that it's about being social. It's just another way to meet people, to find out if you like them on a personal level, and then to take that personal level and say, you know what, I really like how you are, I like how you do business, and so I want to get to know you better. And then you might take that to the next step of, okay, let's go out and have meet in person, have coffee, and talk a little bit about your business. It's the same thing.
I think your line of reasoning and thinking is very sound, and what you just talked about is profound in that it personalizes. It's an opportunity for you to become to show yourself as a person in addition to a practitioner, which people, it sort of reverts back to the old days, if you will, when business was done on a very personal level without the technology and the tools. Now the technology allows you to regain that feeling of getting to know somebody. But you had also mentioned to me that while all of that is true, your blog was picked up by some significant publications in your industry. Could you share with our audience a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, I was really kind of happy about that. Well, blogging is a social kind of activity. In other words, people who blog are very social with each other, and they pick up different, you know, they'll read your blog and they'll talk, and they may mention it on another venue, on their venue or whatever. But for me, I was flattered by some of the bloggers who've picked me up, but I was extremely flattered by Accounting Tomorrow. And these are the same, Accounting Tomorrow is the same media group that does like Accounting Today, and they publish like the top 100 most influential people in accounting and the top 100 CPA firms, that this media group. And Liz Gold, she's one of the persons who maintains the blog over at Accounting Tomorrow, and she had mentioned that she'd wrote a little piece on how she thought my blog site was cool. She calls it her cool blog alert. So I was like, oh, that's really great, kudos. I was very giddy over that, because I thought, oh, well, you know, this is a established media outlet that specializes in the accounting industry, and if they're noticing my blog and mentioning it in their publication, then I kind of feel like I've reached some kind of level of yay, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So a little pat on my own back, I have to say.
And that's why I wanted to ask you about that, because I think that's a significant opportunity that our listening audience needs to also realize, is that people can be. You can be reached and seen by people that maybe in other worlds you wouldn't have had that opportunity to get that recognition. Yeah, I'm sure that some of our guests are listening going, yeah, that works for Stacy, but, you know, I just don't have the time to keep a blog up. It's, you know, it's just going to be more work, more headache. I'll run out of things to talk about. From your experience, can you tell the audience a little bit about what you do to keep your blog content current and the discipline of posting to your blog?
Well, yeah, I mean, it really is easy to get caught up in the whole blogging thing. So you've got to be careful about your time, especially if you like to write. If you don't like to write, or it seems like a real chore for you, blogging is probably not the thing you want to do. You might want to, you know, think of something else, because you do need to be current about it. And it's important that if you are going to blog, that you set limits about how much time you're willing to devote to the whole thing. But for me personally, I derive the majority of my blog posts for my Stacy's More Tax Tips, because I posted that almost every day. But I derive the majority of my blog posts from that directly from the IRS. And a lot of people may not know this, but the IRS will send you emails and press releases and tax tips and other kinds of guidance directly to your email so you can read it. And I, a lot of times, take that information that I get directly from them. Sometimes I'll modify it a little bit, but mostly I just post it directly to my blog because it's current and it's topical for, you know, my Stacey's More Tax Tips. And then maybe at least once a week I write some original commentary that I post on that. My other blog, The Business Perspective, I don't post that as often, maybe once a month, because I like to keep the More Tax Tips more current. But, you know, like I said before, the thing about blogging is that it's a social experience. So if you aren't getting any interaction at your blog site or interacting at other blog sites, you probably aren't going to be getting any traffic to your blog. And if nobody's aware of it or reading it, then, you know, really, what's the point? Right?
But, yeah, it's like standing out in the woods talking to yourself.
Yeah, it's like, why do it? But you know what? If I was going to advise someone about starting a blog, first I would tell them to determine what kind of content they want their blog to contain, who the expected audience will be, how you want to market your blog, because you have to market it. It's like any other kind of media, and how much time you want to spend on it. So, for example, if you wanted to write a blog meant to be an information source for your clients, then you want to consider how you're going to let your clients know about the content and how often you update the information. And the same goes if you're targeting other service providers or potential new clients. You have to do some research to find out how you're going to target these people and find out if they're looking at your site. And there's free ways to figure out if people are actually visiting your site through Google and different other kinds of sources. You can attach different kinds of things on the web to your blog, and it will tell you how many people have been there, if they Googled, what they Googled to find your site, you know, where they're located, like if they're coming from a specific domain. So you can kind of track that. And if you find that nobody's actually visiting your site or doing it, well, then you got to take a step back and go, you know, why am I doing this? But so those kind of things are important to consider, so you aren't wasting your time, because, again, blogging is definitely a marketing strategy. It's marketing. And if you're marketing, then you need to be hitting a certain target audience group. So you need to figure out how to do that. And there's actually classes and people who are willing out there to teach you how to do that. And it's relatively inexpensive, and it doesn't take a lot of time.
You know, you're probably, from my experience with your blog, you've hit on a formula that is working for your brand in the market, and now you're just kind of replicating it and growing it, which is wonderful. You're a knowledge broker and you're a conduit for people to learn, which is great. That's how your blog is set. Yeah. How do you see social media, things like your blog, affecting the business service sector now that you've been doing it for a while and sort of looking at a lot over the landscape of other service providers? How do you see that affecting it?
Well, you know what, I have to talk in terms of now and later. For now, I think the biggest impact is going to be in attracting and retaining talent, because I believe that because most of the social networkers that I'm seeing out there, there is a broad range of people, but most of the people I see out there who are actively social networking are younger, and particularly on, like, Facebook. These people are relating to each other and networking via the Internet, and I think it's important that we understand how this communication form is working. And, of course, I don't expect that the traditional referral source dating, that's what I call it, referral source dating, in the in-person scenario will ever go away. But back in the day, and I think I mentioned this before, when marketers might go out and take golf lessons as a way to be able to maybe interact socially, today we might want to look at taking lessons to learn how to use social networking so that we can meet people and interact. I think the younger group are really kind of taking hold of that and meeting and networking for jobs that way. So that's important. For in the future, gosh, you know what? I hate to speculate about how it's going to be in the future because, you know, we had that big .com thing, and, you know, everybody thought that was going to be, you know, the big thing. I really don't know. But for right now, I think that firms who want to attract the younger, talented group of people, that it's important that they understand how the social networking stuff is working. And, you know, I just recently read a post by jobsportalwatch.com, and they took a survey of hiring managers, where in that survey the hiring managers indicated that 75% of them were looking at LinkedIn to research credentials of potential candidates for jobs. I mean, that's a big number, 75%.
Right.
So for people who aren't, you know, if you're not on LinkedIn right now, you might consider getting out there, getting your resume out there, because people are looking there. Myself, personally, I've probably had 5 job offers in the last year from people who pulled my resume off of LinkedIn. Hmm. So, you know, I think that that's important for people to understand and learn how to utilize, because if they're not, the people who are utilizing it and learning how to do it, those are the people that are going to be a few steps above you in
right.
terms of getting those jobs.
So how would someone who's in our listening audience find out more about you on the Internet? Where would you direct them?
Well, of course, I've got my website, which is www.clifford-kits-cpa.com. But I do have quite a web presence, so if you Google Stacy Clifford Kits, you're going to get a whole bunch of pages and pages of me. So I'm pretty easy to find.
Okay. Well, I have, you know, the time has just flown by. I've really enjoyed this time together. I appreciate you playing through the pain and being on the show for our audience, even though you are battling your own flu symptoms over there. So let me just say, on behalf of the listening audience and Doug, thanks, Stacy, for being our guest this afternoon on Critical Mass, the radio show.
Well, thanks for having me. I really had enjoyed it. It was fun.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
I'd like to turn our attention now to our second guest here on Critical Mass, the radio show. And our second guest is Kelly Adams. Kelly, are you online?
Yes, I am.
How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Rick.
I'm excited to have you on the show. Kelly is going to talk with us about the importance of performance management to a firm's long-term success and the role that the top executive business owner plays in setting the tone regarding performance management. And I have to say that I've worked with Kelly in professional capacity where I've seen her in action, and I know for a fact that she believes emphatically in what we're going to talk about here in this next segment. And I, too, believe that by listening to someone and working with someone of the caliber of Kelly Adams in this area, a wide range of companies will perform better over the long term, because, unfortunately, in my experience being in corporate America and working with company owners and business executives, many of them are uncomfortable with the whole idea of the concept of performance management. So we're going to get into that a little bit, because I'm excited about the kind of content that Kelly is ready to talk with you about this afternoon. But Kelly, before we do that, let's just spend a minute, and I'm going to ask you to tell our audience about the path to your current firm, which I didn't mention yet, which is KJA and Associates. So could you tell us about your path to KJA and Associates?
My path to KJA and Associates started out, Rick, in the early 80s. I began in a human resources department working for a restaurant distribution firm, and moved over to healthcare, where I spent another 10 or so more years. From there, I went on to a public entity, the Orange County Sanitation Wastewater Treatment Plant, and spent a couple years there as the HR manager. And it was there that I had the epiphany that I needed to take all of my HR experience and education and apply it in a multitude of variables in terms of HR activities. And I could only do that if I broke out of the corporate box and the pigeonhole, if you will. So I founded KJA and Associates.
Okay.
A human resource consulting firm.
Perfect. So tell the audience now, you know, I kind of prefaced part of what I know that you do and do very well, which is working with performance management systems. But can you talk about what it is that you've been doing since you started your firm in 1998?
Yes, primarily the performance management. But in addition to that, I work with organizations in manpower planning, reorganizations, compliance. I do a lot of compliance consulting with business owners who are unsure of how to handle situations in the workplace, or you know, policy and procedure writing, employee handbooks. We're pretty much, KJ and Associates is pretty much a full-service human resource consulting firm, if you will.
My experience, my direct experience relating with working with you, Kelly, is kind of with firms with 25 employees and larger. Does that fit with where KJ and Associates focuses its marketing efforts, or what part of the market are and size of clients are you generally engaging with?
Well, I have no industry specific because I feel that you know, you often see in job postings that companies are looking, in terms of HR people, they're looking for someone that might have technical experience or distribution experience. Well, you know, our philosophy at KJ and Associates is that people are people, no matter what type industry you're putting them in. And the same applications are going to apply to those people in a distribution firm or a healthcare firm. You might have different regulations in healthcare and distribution that you need to be aware of. But for the most part, people are people. So we don't have a niche industry. We do a lot of work with the restaurant industry and entertainment, you know, and there's no correlation between the two. But people are people. So there's, you know, there's not a lot of variables in that sense. Yes, 25 employees is, you know, that's when the business owner starts to say, look, you know, we're growing. I think we need to put some processes in place. I do have a soft spot in my heart for the passionate business owner who may be at 10 employees and is like, wow, you know, I want to build the infrastructure now. I want to put it in place, all the more to ease my growing pains. And I love that philosophy, and I can't turn down a business owner of 10 employees that's looking to put in some sound practices to, in which to grow his business.
Okay. The third question we'd like to ask is, of all of our guests, you know, of all the particular experiences that you've had and the lessons that you've learned, is there an overarching guiding principle that you use in how you run your business and apply it to your practice?
Well, I think first and foremost, being an ethical business owner, and that's something I look for in the clients that I serve. I want to work for ethical business owners who want to do the right thing, follow the laws, and do the right thing for their employees.
Well, that makes sense with the line of work that you're in relative to performance management. And really, from my understanding of your perspective and how you implement and work with owners to implement performance management systems, mm-hmm. it really is giving them the employee an opportunity to feel like their voice is heard within the firm as well, mm-hmm. in a way that isn't combative and competitive, et cetera. So that makes sense how you answered that question, that it kind of leads us to our mainline conversation that we wanted to have with you this afternoon, which is, again, many times the concept, Kelly, of performance management feels like a four-letter word to a business owner or a top executive or a line manager. Just that icky, I got to meet with the people and it's just going to, you know, how do I not do that or control it so much? So can you talk to us about your philosophy of what the term performance management means?
Sure. My philosophy of performance management is that you're establishing performance guidelines for your employees or for your human capital, okay? Most likely, your human capital is your largest budget item. So performance management is no different, Rick, than, say, financial management. You need to put some things in place in order to manage it and grow it, and that's how, you know, you look at your employees. So, you know, some of the things that are underpinnings of a good performance management system would be the company's vision, mission, and goal statement. And with the creation of that, it flows down into your job descriptions. Your job descriptions become your performance reviews. And it just, it's a trickle-down effect, but, you know, but it all begins at the top with the vision, mission, and goals. And without that, you are a company is a fish without a tail in the water, a boat without a rudder, if you will. You know, you just, yeah, how do you run your organization if you don't know what those three things are? And with those three things, you just expound on everything else in your organization.
Well, you exposed me to a simple question that you advise your clients to ask as they kind of embark on a performance review or performance management system. Maybe you can talk a little bit about it. And you said, why are you paying them to be here?
Yes, exactly. Why do they show up? Why do your employees show up to work, and why are you paying them to be there? Oftentimes, a company that does not have a sound performance management program in place, meaning that you've got some specific goals and objectives for your folks to live up to, which, by the way, those goals and objectives should be tying back into your mission, values, and your mission and values statement, as I mentioned earlier. The employees' goals and objectives are going to tie into that. Otherwise, you are paying them to sit in a chair and keep the desk warm. And your employees are going to be wondering, why is it that I show up for work every day? And I've got to tell you that oftentimes I go out and I do focus groups with organizations of all different sizes, and performance management is usually the thing that we're looking for in our focus group sessions. And 9 out of 10 times employees will say, I'm not sure what my job is or why I'm there. Okay, well, that says that you probably don't have a sound performance management program in place.
And it's unfortunate that it takes a focus group, although good for you from a business model perspective. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I know that you know the best practices, and we're sort of touching on those. And, you know, what's your philosophy on how often reviews – I mean, I think some business owners and top executives feel like an annual review is almost too often. You know, oh, I got to do that again.
Yeah.
Didn't I just do that? But, I mean, what's your philosophy on how frequent reviews should be?
Well, I think that, you know, my philosophy is that it's ongoing. Yes, oftentimes it's an annual review cycle. But, you know, to wait until the end of the year, whether it be calendar year, fiscal year, to touch base with your employee and say, wow, you didn't quite make the mark on some of the goals and objectives I had set for you. Better luck next review period. What the heck has just happened over the past 11 months? I spoke earlier about the employee who's sitting in the chair just keeping the desk warm. Well, you know, not really, because here they've muddled through 11 months. How much salary have you paid that person for 11 months to not come back and try and fine-tune their performance? And so what I recommend in my philosophy is that performance is an ongoing thing, Rick. And, you know, what I tell CFOs is, how often do you look at your financial reports? You're probably touching those at least once a month, I would guess. Performance management should be no different. You should be having conversations with your staff ongoing. So when you come to your annual review period, it's as simple as just doing a summary of the conversations you've had throughout the year. Once you get into that mode of operation, it becomes painless at the end of the year. Yes, you're going to have the times where the conversation is difficult because it's an uncomfortable conversation that you need to have if the employee has not improved or has some serious deficits. That's not comfortable, but it's got to be. I mean, you've got to have that heart-to-heart, and that's why supervisors get the big nickels, is to have those conversations. But, you know, I think that oftentimes performance management is put on the back burner because it is so uncomfortable to have confrontation. Managers tell me, oh, my gosh, it's so time-consuming. And depending on if you're doing focal point reviews, which is, okay, you know, all of my staff has their reviews due in December. Well, that could be painful depending on your work group size. You know, maybe it's better for the manager to spread it out throughout the year in writing the annual reviews is what I'm speaking of, because I just mentioned that you should be having these conversations ongoing throughout the entire year. So
you use the phrase, the word conversation. So spend a minute with the audience and with me, and because that my sense is that some people are worried about having a conversation for fear it turns into a confrontation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They maybe are more comfortable with a monologue. You listen, I'll talk, and then I'll get out of here before you have a chance to disagree with whatever I say. I'm not saying everybody's that way, but, I've been around a little bit, seen it happen before. So talk to me about your philosophy of how you should show up inside that performance management system as the manager.
Well, I think it's, to diffuse or to be prepared to diffuse what could be an uncomfortable situation is managers should have the employees assess their performance and turn it in to you, the manager, prior to that meeting. So you know exactly where they're coming from. And, maybe there's something that you as the manager forgot about. And here again, if you're touching base with them on a more frequent basis, you're probably not going to forget about the more significant contributions they've made to the organization throughout the year. But let's say you forget something. Hopefully they're going to have it in their review, and you're going to look at that prior to meeting with them. Oh, yes, I forgot to write about that. And you can go back and adjust your notes and comments. So, employees oftentimes have negative comments to say about doing a self-assessment. They think, why am I doing this? This is what my boss gets paid for. And that's really silly because they should have some input on how they feel about their performance. But, sometimes it's hard to look in the mirror and really truthfully write what you feel about yourself. But I think, Rick, to answer your question, in doing that ahead of time, for the employee to present that to the manager, it's going to be far less painful and confrontational if it's prepared ahead of time.
Plus, as you were answering that and talking, I was listening and thinking, it also ties to the idea of giving specific feedback.
Yes.
You talk about an employee who lists a significant accomplishment that they had that you might have neglected to put in their performance review if you didn't get their feedback. Mm-hmm. I would think also that helps in being a very specific, having a specific set of things that were accomplished or not accomplished.
Right.
So what's your opinion on having, the details and the facts, but in a way that isn't, it's not a court of law here. We're not trying to, exhibit A, you didn't do this in time, that kind of a thing.
Well, I think it's important to, depending on the criteria that you're reviewing them on, I think it's important to give examples and to back up your statements with an example or two. Rather than just checking the box that they met expectations, okay, well, can you give an example or two over the course of 12 months where you could substantiate that they met expectations? And maybe if you're trying to prod this person into the next box of, exceeds expectations, give them an example or two as it relates to that individual's workplace of what they could do to achieve the next box that could be checked off. So it's disheartening when I see the performance management software that's out there on the market and just allows for the canned comments and, the checked boxes, and it's just a very impersonal performance review. Employees want some specifics that they can wrap their arms around, and, it gives them clarity as to where they're headed.
And when you're, from a best practices perspective, how many core responsibilities would you recommend that a typical performance review, performance management system contain?
Well, I think that, I generally say 4 to 5. And those core responsibilities, if I may back up for just a moment, I talked earlier about your values, your mission and vision statement, and from that rolls down a whole bunch of other things, including from day one, the offer letter that's given to the employee. And you're going to have no more than 5 bullet points in the offer letter that says, here's what you're going to do for the organization. And that's derived from the job description that you created from your mission, vision, and value statement. So hopefully you're seeing the pattern here, Rick. It all rolls up.
Right.
So then your offer letter has 4 to 5 significant core responsibilities that they're going to either accept the job or decline the position based on those responsibilities. Those then are rolled down into your performance review as some core objectives. So, to answer your question, 4 to 5 is usually my rule of thumb. But if there are significant goals that, you know, you may want to take a look at that and go, wow, that might be a little overwhelming for this person. Maybe for this review period we need to scale it back to one or two just because they're weighted so heavily. You know, does that make sense?
Yes, and I think that's a very it seems almost obvious, no disrespect intended, but it seems so powerful that if there were reasons why you had to hire a person in the first place, and to the degree that those are consistent over the life of the term of the position or maybe the first year, to link all those together seemed to me to be a very thoughtful way to do it. So really, you know, you want to do it right the first time, right? Like you said, when you get them in the door. So that's a powerful concept of linking those two. I wouldn't have thought of that necessarily without your kind of raising it up to me. But now once you say it, it seems so obvious that it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, so. And so, you know, when the manager says, my gosh, why am, you know, I don't want to do a job description. I just want to get the body in the door and get him, put him to work. You know, well, hold on. You know, there starts the whole problem.
Right. And it goes back to your earlier question, which was, why are you paying this person? It's all... It seems to me to be very evident if you can do it from the beginning. Now, many of the people that will be listening to this interview are going to go, well, I've already hired these people, and I've been doing it this way for years, and you know, I just can't drop pixie dust on my shop and have it turn around and be different. So what advice would you give for a business owner or a top executive who's listening today going, hey, that sounds like a really good system, but I'm nowhere near that today?
Well, baby steps, because it can be very overwhelming for an organization to just suddenly, as you said, sprinkle the pixie dust in and say, poof, we now are following a sound performance management system. Because, again, you know, do you have your mission, vision, and guiding principles? If I'll sum it all up as guiding principles. Do you have your guiding principles in place? That's where the business owner should start. Put that in place, and the rest of it is just baby steps in developing it and rolling it out. And it may take a year, year and a half to do so, but it's a year and a half of time very well spent, especially if your organization has any intention of growing, which I do believe that once our economy turns around here, and I think all of your listeners would agree, it is going to turn around. This is cyclical. Savvy are the business owners that today are looking at their performance management and positioning their company to be the most competitive they can be. Because, Rick, once we come out of this downturn, the talent wars will be on. And the losers are going to be the ones that don't have the guiding principles, that don't have the sound, solid performance management programs in place in their companies. They're going to be left with the non-talent in their company, and their competitors are going to pass them right on by.
I agree, and we're just about to publish our Q4 index, and it was interesting to see how many companies are growing this year. Greater than 30% so far in the early returns on the survey are growing in 2009. So, I mean, there are companies that are continuing to grow, and I think that's up over the Q3 index. So I agree with you. The recovery is coming, and people need to be ready for that. I guess when the point you made earlier, which is that people are generally the most expensive asset that a company has, that's so true in so many industries. And the what you're doing here with your suggestion that when you talk to a CFO, how often do you look at your financial metrics? It's an interesting corollary to your people metrics, and how often are you reviewing those? And in fact, when you look at your income statement, how much expense is tied to the people? This everything that you've said, it makes so much sense to me that as a best practice is that I would strongly encourage our listening audience to seriously take a look and reflect on how they're handling the performance management within their company. Should they be interested in talking with someone such as yourself about a performance management system, how does someone get in touch with you, Kelly?
Oh, well, we have our website, which is returnonhumancapital.com, and that's return-on-humancapital.com, or they can contact my office at 714-637-1766.
again, this was a kick. I really enjoyed the time that I've spent with you on Critical Mass, the radio show, talking with you about performance management, Kelly Adams. This was just great.
Thank you, Rick. It was a pleasure being on your show, and I'm so passionate about this, and I've seen organizations who have put it in place be successful and remain successful even in these down times. So it's a topic that's near and dear to my heart, and I hope that your listeners will embrace this wholeheartedly and look at it as a recipe for success in their company.
Well, it's clear to me that you are a domain expert in this area and understanding best practices. So I would strongly encourage people to consider, are they really getting the most out of the talent that they have in their organization? And again, I want to say thanks for being a guest on the show, Critical Mass. I'd like to have you back in the future. We can get a little more into some of these aspects that we just touched upon today.
That would be wonderful, Rick. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was another installment of Critical Mass, the radio show, hosted here on octalkradio.net. And I hope that you found the content of both of our guests to be informative. I clearly felt today we had a very strong set of interviews with both our guests, Stacy Clifford Kitts and Kelly Adams, and would ask you if you know of people that would benefit from listening to this interview. It will be available. It will be available on a variety of podcasting systems as well as octalkradio.net's radio station site. So please direct people to come back and listen to these interviews if you think the content would help them as they run their businesses. I've enjoyed our show today. I think that was obvious, and I hope that these interviews have provided you with new ideas and information that you can use to make better, more informed decisions. If you'd like to learn more about Critical Mass for Business and Executive Forums, I would encourage you to check out our website, which is www.criticalmassforbusiness. You also see our email address for Doug or for Rick. Give us a, connect with us, and we'll be happy to speak with you. And so until next week, I hope all your decisions move your company in a positive direction.
You've been listening to Critical Mass, only on OC Talk Radio.